It's time to take your seat in the front row with Mike Vaccaro. Here's your host, Mike Vaccaro.
Hey, thank you, Chuck. Welcome, everybody, once again in the front row. I am your host, Mike Vaccaro. Behind the scenes, as always, JR Quitman, our creator, producer, and director. We thank you for continuing to watch and listen to our episodes and always remind you to subscribe if you have not already. Great guests coming up. A lot of guests in the next couple of weeks. Right now, we go back to baseball. It's been a little while since we talked baseball, but we do that today with Sean Casey. Casey, who grew up just outside of Pittsburgh, went to Richmond, and a great story how he got there off the advice from his dad. Eventually drafted by the Indians, traded to the Cincinnati Reds, where he had 8 great years, moved on from there, would play in the World Series with the Tigers, and retire after one season with the Red Sox. He shares his journey with us, so many great influences along the way as well. Now a member of the media, working for MLB Network, and he's got his own podcast. He's known as The Mayor, and he's got The Mayor podcast as well. We'll dive into all that today on this episode, episode number 57, featuring former baseball player, current MLB Network analyst, Sean Casey. Sean, I appreciate your time here today. So much to get into with you as far as being a player, obviously an analyst now, a fellow podcaster as well. We're going to get into all this, but you know, we always want to start with our guests at the very beginning. And for you, born in New Jersey, but really raised outside of Pittsburgh, how did that make you maybe the person that you are today and even the athlete that you became as well?
Well, you know, it's funny when you look back at life. You know, I think when we first moved to Jersey, I was I grew up in Jersey. I was 5 years old when I moved to Pittsburgh. So I grew up in Pittsburgh, but you're right. But my family's from New York and New Jersey. And I think when we first moved there, my mom was so mad at my dad. He was, you know, my dad got a job here in Pittsburgh. My mom's like, we're moving to Pittsburgh in 1980. Like, you got to be kidding me. Like, we have our whole families in Jersey and New York, and what's going on? So I think initially for our family, what looked like a negative turned out to be the biggest positive ever. I mean, there's so many incredible things along my journey. It happened because of, you know, being raised in Pittsburgh. And, you know, I think one of the biggest things my dad, you know, one of the biggest points he made was just like, hey, we're moving to a blue collar city. You know, these people are hardworking people. And, you know, we kind of saw ourselves like that in our household. And my dad was a hardworking man. And so was my mom, you know, was a hardworking woman. And they just came from good Irish, you know, Catholic backgrounds, you know, of bigger families and, you know, workers. And that was just always the mentality my dad really kind of raised us with, my mom and dad. And, you know, I think being in the city of Pittsburgh and growing up here I grew up in a town called Upper St. Clair, right outside of Pittsburgh. Great education, and just very grateful I grew up here, Mike. It was just a wonderful, wonderful place.
Obviously, you excelled at baseball. Were you playing other sports as well growing up?
Dude, I played everything all the way up, you know, and I recommend that to kids. You know, I played, probably soccer was my other best sport. I was a really good soccer goalie, you know, and I end up getting pressured. When you live in Western Pennsylvania, you get pressured to play football. So in like freshman year in high school, I left soccer, which I probably shouldn't have, to play football. And that was not my sport. You know, I was on the defensive line. I was just like I was like, when do I touch the ball? Do we touch the ball here? Like, no, you're a pulling guard. You just pull out, and if you don't get to the corner, the linebacker kills the running back, and your career was basically over. My career ended. I broke my wrist my freshman year and really struggled in baseball that year and never really came back to football. So football ended that way. Basketball ended because I really wasn't quick enough, and I only dribbled to the right side. I could shoot free throws, which was really good. I could have a decent jump shot. And then I realized I could hit a baseball, and I just started about my sophomore year in high school. I started just hitting a baseball every day, and that worked out for me.
Yeah, obviously it did. It seemed like football, the injuries of football have sent a lot of guys, a lot of athletes to other sports to excel in. You know, you took off, like you said, in high school. At one point, did you, you know, see that, okay, this is going to get me to college. This is going to get me to the next level. And when did, you know, coaches start recruiting you?
Yeah. Never. You know, when I look back, it's funny. You know, really quick story. My journey wasn't like, you know, I wasn't the big prospect. I wasn't the guy that you thought would, you know, this guy's definitely going to play in the bigger, or this guy's even going to play college baseball. You know, I really had no offers coming out of high school. I remember my senior year, I was a good hitter. I worked really hard at my craft. And I remember my senior year, I was a lot of my friends were getting ready to go off to college, and some playing college football, some playing college baseball. And I remember saying to my dad, like at the beginning of my senior year, like, man, Dad, I have no college scholarship offers. And I really think I'm a Division I hitter, but I'll take Division II or III too. I don't care. I just need somebody that, you know, would take a shot. And my dad at the time was starting a company, you know, his company called Casey Chemical. It was a chemical surfactant clearinghouse company. And he was starting it out of our home. He was doing a lot of network marketing, sending out envelopes and, you know, sending out brochures to people, hoping to get guys that were interested that had product that he could sell. And I remember my dad coming home and say one day was like, I was like, Dad, I don't know what's going on. Like, nobody's coming before me. And I remember him saying to me, you know, you got to learn a lesson in life, Sean. Like, nobody is coming for you. You know, nobody's coming to give you anything in life. You got to go take it. And you got to play offense, not defense in your life. And it was just such a big lesson for me. He's like, listen, if you want to go to colleges, you want to go play Division I, Division II, Division III baseball, these coaches don't know about you, obviously. He's like, why don't you sit down tomorrow after school and write 30 letters to 30 places that you want to go? And he said, you know, we'll sit down and after school, we'll do it. So I came after school one day, I sat down at my dad's desk. He's like, let's get going. So I did. Boom. I wrote the first letter. Dear Clemson, dear Penn State, you know, I'm Sean Casey. I'm a great hitter. I'm a gap to gap guy. I'm a great teammate. I work really hard, you know, and then College of Worcester, Marietta. I remember all these colleges I sent them to, all these different schools. And my dad's message was, you know, you got to play offense, not defense. Go to them. If they're not going to come to you, go to them, you know? And I remember after the 30th letter, can't remember to who it was, I was getting up to be done. My dad says, hey, write one more letter. He pulled out a brochure. It's like, University of Richmond sent you this brochure last year at the Keystone State Games. He's like, send them one. So I sat down for the 31st letter. You know, dear Coach Atkins, Coach McQueen, you know, my name's Sean Casey. You know, I'd love to come to University of Richmond. I didn't even know what University of Richmond was. I didn't know a ton of these colleges. I just knew I wanted to play Division I baseball. And these are some of the schools I had been connected to at some point, or that I wanted to, you know, that I wanted to reach out to. So sure enough, bro, my high school career, you know, starts going down the path, and I am one of the best players in the area now. I think I'm one of the better players, you know, in the state as a hitter. I'm hitting 450, 500. I'm driving balls in the gap. I'm, you know, I don't strike out at all. I think I struck out once and twice in 2 years in varsity baseball. And I remember thinking my dad's mantra of preparation meeting opportunity, be prepared. So when the opportunity comes, you'll be ready for it. I'm like, man, this guy, I think he's full of crap. Like, there's been no opportunities here in the last 3 years. So I remember with four games to go in my high school career, I end up hitting, you know, best game of my life, bro. Bases loaded, double in the gap, two-run score. Bases loaded again, double in the other gap, left center gap, two-run score. I remember going 4-for-4, 8 RBIs. And Jerry Malarkey, who was my coach at the time in high school, come up to me when I was walking out for the seventh inning and goes, hey, Case, how many hits you got today? I got 4 hits. He's like, how many RBIs? 8 RBIs. How many doubles? 4 doubles. He's like, man, that's awesome. He's like, you see the guy over there behind the backstop? That's Mark McQueen. He's the recruiting coordinator for the University of Richmond. Drove 6 hours to come see you play on the count of the letter you sent a few months ago.
Wow.
I was like, wow, that's incredible. So after the game, I went over to Coach Mack. He was like, man, I really like your swing. It's been a joy to watch. I drove 6 hours up here. He's like, we'd like to offer you $1,000 scholarship. And I think at the time Richmond was like 30 grand. My dad made like 33 grand. You know, I was doing the math going, I don't know if I can afford that. But I was like, you know, I remember telling my dad, you know, Richmond wants to give me $1,000. And I was like, what do we do? Cause I don't know if we're going to be able to afford it. He's like, we'll figure it out. He's like, you know, we'll get financial aid. We'll get a second mortgage if we have to, but you got to go. And that's how I ended up at University of Richmond. And, you know, my freshman year, I started, it was a freshman All-American. My sophomore year, had a great year, went to the Cape Cod League. And yeah, then my junior year, I won the NCAA batting title. He was the best hitter in Division I baseball. And I just think back to that conversation with my dad. Like, you know, you got to play offense, not defense in your life. Like, you know, no one's coming for you. You got to go to them. And sure enough, I owe the University of Richmond a lot, and Coach Mack and Coach Atkins, you know, a lot for, you know, believing in me and giving me a shot to come play there.
Yeah, I'm impressed. Number one, you wrote letters, you know.
Yeah,
you do that these days. But back then, it was the 90s. You wrote letters. You didn't have social media to get your name out there. But as you said, it was the right fit for you. It was a right fit for Richmond. And your junior season, not only, you know, did you lead the country in batting average, as you mentioned, You had the triple crown in the CAA that year, home runs, RBIs as well. Obviously, your game translated to the CAA, to Richmond at that time. What was it? What helped you excel for Richmond?
You know what? For me, I try and tell my kids and the kids that I work with in baseball, you know, you get better on your own. You don't get better at practice. You don't get better, you know, you get better on your own. And there was a lot of nights I spent at the Robbins Center there at University of Richmond where they played basketball. You know, our baseball facilities weren't that great at the time. You know, they're getting a little better, but there was a cage we called the dungeon. It was literally in the dungeon. It was in the basement of the Robbins Center. And I would go every night, every day at some point by myself, make sure if anyone was in there, I'd walk out. And I would set up the tee, and I would turn on Pearl Jam and AC/DC Back in Black. I'd listen to those albums, and I'd just hit buckets of balls at the left center part of the cage. And I also believe, like, you know, intentional repetitions is where skill mastery lives. Like, so I was in the cages with intention to drive that ball to left center corner every single time. And, I didn't leave the cage till I would hit, like, 50 to 100 balls in that left center corner and listen to those two albums. And, I believe that was the thing that kind of took me to another level. I believe when you're in the batting cages, you're in the confidence cage. And I believe in those cages by yourself is where you start to build inner trust in yourself. Whenever I got in that batter's box for those 3 years at Richmond, I was like, no one's hit more than I have. I don't care who you are. I don't care how good of a pitcher you are. Like, you're not going to get velo by me. And you're going to have a tough time pitching to me. And it just was a confidence thing more than anything. So I always encourage kids and my kids, hey, listen, you know, the only way you're really going to go to another level is alone. Because at the end of the day, you stand in the box alone. And if you pitch on the mound, you're alone. And you're out in the field, you're alone. It's the ultimate team sport. It's the ultimate sport that's a team sport, but it's really an individual sport. It's like golf in a team setting. So you better be pretty confident in yourself and in your mind frame to believe that you're the best out there. And I think that mindset really took me to another level, Mike. You know, I think everyone had a lot of skills, and I saw a lot of guys in Division I and on my team and around me that had a lot of skills, maybe some better than I had. Yeah. But at the end of the day, I feel like I put in some work that was a little different.
Yeah, it's a great lesson as a dad of a 12-year-old baseball player now. That's great lessons, the work that you do. As you said, you're kind of alone in that batter's box on the pitcher's mound as well. And, you know, you excelled. You were the player of the year in the conference, second team All-American. And then later on, 2003, you're inducted into the Richmond Hall of Fame. So as you look back again, the last letter you write, a school you really didn't think you were going to go to, and here you're in their Athletics Hall of Fame. It's got to be an incredible journey from that standpoint.
Yeah, well, the first day I saw the University of Richmond was the first day of school started. I was like, oh, this is nice. You know, I had never even been there. So, you know, to be in the Richmond Hall of Fame, you know, I'm very humbled by the whole thing too, because I think one thing I do know, Mike, is I didn't get here alone. Like, I didn't do all this alone. I know I took those swings alone, but, you know, my hitting coach, Frank Porco in high school, you know, my Jerry Malarkey, who was my coach, you know, here, a lot of the teammates, Coach McQueen taking the time to come see me, Coach Atkins, you know, being such a great coach for me in college and a role model, all the teammates I had and all that. So all those great teams, I mean, that 95 team, we went to regionals that year. Those guys are still some of my best friends in the world. So, you know, when I went in the Richmond Hall of Fame, you know, it was really more of a thing. I was very, very humbled to go in there, and that meant a lot to me, you know, because a lot of great players have come before, you know, even, you know, the Brian Jordans and you know, so many different players in all the different sports through there, all the basketball teams and the great Sean Barbers and Mark Megnas and, you know, all the guys that have played on the football teams. And so I was very, very honored to go in there, Mike. I was very, very humbled.
As you mentioned, you went to the Cape Cod League after your sophomore season, before that junior season as well. Is that where you really started to make a name for yourself the pro scouts had a chance to see, oh, the Sean Casey guy from Richmond, he's pretty good.
That was the place, man. When I went to the Cape, you know, that was the place. You know, you walk in and you got, you know, Todd Helton's there for the summer. It was, oh, it's Todd Helton and Darren Erstadt and Mike Lowell was there, and a lot of great players were there in that summer, 94. But that's what, you know, I end up hitting .340 and leading the league in RBIs. And I remember thinking to myself, if these are the best players in the country, these are the guys who are going to be the first, second round picks of pro ball next year, I got a shot. you know, I didn't know that I was, you know, that I could hang with the guys that were best in the country, because you don't know till you know. And after the Cape Cod League, I walked out of there with my chest even a little higher to say, nah, I'm one of the best hitters in the country. And then, you know, winning the NCAA batting title that next year, by junior year, you know, I kind of proved it to myself. So just like I said, to have that experience to play in the Cape and to be able to compete against the best in the country really boosted my confidence more to show me that, like, hey, you're right here. You're right where you need to be.
Yeah, again, 461 batting average, your junior season to lead the country, as you said, in the average. So obviously draft eligible at that time. You get drafted second round by the Cleveland Indians. Was there any chance of you coming back for a senior season, or did you think, okay, this the next step here, it's here for me?
No, I think it was nothing more to prove at college baseball. So, you know, when I was the second round pick of the Indians, I was ready to get out there and pro ball and see if I, you know, had a shot to make it to the big league. So yeah, I was ready to go. And, you know, I can't believe I got drafted in the second round. Like I said, 3 years earlier, I was begging colleges to take a shot at me, you know, and then 3 years later, I was a second round pick of the Cleveland Indians. Incredible to me.
Yeah, that was 1995, a couple of years in minor league ball. And then you get the call up, you get the chance for your Major League Baseball debut. Do you remember that? Can you take us through
yeah.
That?
Oh man, I remember it like it was yesterday. Yeah, we had just won the night before we had won the AAA championship, and I was fortunate enough to hit a home run to win the game in the 10th in Iowa. And after the game, I came in, the champagne's going, and Mark Shapiro at the time, who was the minor league coordinator for the Indians, and Brian Graham, who was the manager, you know, they called me in the office. They're like, hey, congratulations on the home run. I'm like, oh, thanks so much. They're like, hey, your season's not over. Like, you're going to meet the big league team tomorrow in Chicago. And I remember just being like, I started to cry. I just was, it was the best conversation probably of my life. And I just remember feeling like, this is incredible. And I just wanted to talk to my parents. I ran out, you know, there was no cell phones back then. So I found a payphone. I dialed up the credit card, called my mom and dad. They answered. I was like, I just hit the home run to win the AAA championship. And you're not going to believe this. They just called me up to the big leagues tomorrow. I'm meeting the team in Chicago to play the White Sox. And, you know, my parents are like, we'll be there. They start crying. I'm crying. They're like, we'll be there. So the next day in Chicago, we show up, and we're walking in the clubhouse being like so nervous. And Matt Williams is one of the first guy that I crossed paths with. I shake his hand. He's like, nice to meet you. I'm like, oh my God. Like, I was such a big Will Clark fan growing up. He was kind of my idol. And Matt Williams, so I followed the Giants, and Matt Williams was the big third baseman on all those Giants teams. And so I was like, wow, I just shook Matt Williams' hand. You got to be kidding me. And then I was like, Jim Thome and Manny Ramirez and Oral Hershiser and Dave Justice. So many guys came over, and it was just such a cool moment. And that night we're in the dugout, and I'm thinking, man, I just hope I don't even care if I get in or not. I'm just so glad to be here. And in the eighth inning, we're sitting at the end of the bench, and Johnny Gorel, who was the bench coach, I believe, at the time, came up. He's like, Case, he's like, if Dave Justice hits, you're going to hit for him. I'm like, oh my God, Dave Justice. Like, even those names, I mean, my name being in the same sentence with Dave Justice and these guys that I grew up watching. So sure enough, Dave Justice going to hit. They pull him back, and here I go to hit. And what's funny was, none of my equipment came from Buffalo. Our equipment, for whatever reason, didn't make it on the flight, or, you know, so it had to be shipped, you know, the next series. So I'm going up for my first big league at bat. I got no helmet. I got no bat, no batting gloves. And I remember going to the rack, and I'm looking, you know, when you get to the big leagues, you know, now you got the 1 ear flap helmet. That's why, that's what you play for. You know, you're in the minors and the college, you still got the 2 double ear flap. So I get up there, and I don't have a helmet. I'm going through the helmets. I'm a 7 1/4. I pull out Tony Fernandez as a 7 1/4 lefty helmet. And I don't know anybody on the team, but I'm in dire straits right now because I'm about to go up for my first big league at bat. So I walk up to Tony Fernandez. I'm like, Tony, is there any chance I could use your helmet? 7 1/4. He's like, no problem, my friend. So I get take this Tony Fernandez 7 1/4. I get Jeff Manto's batting gloves, another buddy of mine. Mick, can I use your batting gloves? Yeah, use his. Well, now the big thing was the bat, man. Like, your bat's everything. You don't want to go up there with a Jim Thome bat. Like, it'd be like swinging a tree trunk. So I'm like, I got to try and find the model that I swing as anyone swings. So I swung a T141 Louisville at the time. So I was going through the bat rack, pull up Thome's, pull up, you know, all these guys. Then I pull up Manny Ramirez swings a T141. And I'm like, oh my God, I got to do it. I got to go ask him. So I go up to Manny Ramirez, my first bat. I'm like, bro, is there any chance I could swing your T141? I was like, it's my model. He's like, no problem, man. So I go up there with Manny Ramirez's bat, Tony Fernandez's helmet, and Jeff Manto's batting glove for my first big league at bat. I walk out on deck, you know, give my dad a fist pump. see my parents. A couple buddies from Richmond are there too, which was great. Get in my first at bat and facing a guy named Jeff Darwin. I don't even remember the first three pitches. I feel like I was having an out-of-body experience. I was so anxious, and that you can't hit in the big leagues if you're anxious, you know? So I was taking these big swings. I get down one and two, and I'm like, I'm not punching. So I think it was like a wake-up call. I'm like, I'm not punching out my first at bat in the big leagues. Like, let's go. So I remember taking a deep breath, slowing myself down. I get a 1-2 slider from Jeff Darwin. I end up hitting like a hard grounder into the hole, got the hit. And I remember looking up. I remember just at that moment, looking up at my dad, really thinking about some of the conversations we had had over the years, especially that conversation, you know, writing those letters and standing on first base in the big leagues and thinking, we did it. Like, we did it. Like, they can't take this away. Like, I'm in the books forever with one hit in the big leagues. And, you know, all the hard work, all the swings, all that stuff really does pay off if you just keep going, you know? And like, so that first hit for me, man, I'll never, ever forget in Chicago, looking up at my parents and, you know, just kind of having a moment and thinking to myself, like, I did it. You know, and then I got 1,500 more later, 1,500 hits more later. But that first one was probably the biggest.
With Manny Ramirez is bad, as you said, a bunch of equipment, but it certainly worked out. Do you have that ball still? Do you have that?
I have it.
Your first hit?
Yes, I got it right here. Right here.
Wow.
First major league hit. I don't know if you can see it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, isn't that cool? And the Indians, was so cool. They took it from me at New Comiskey Park. It was new in 1997.
Yeah.
They took it and they had an artist. Isn't that cool that they do that? Yeah. They had an artist take it and like do the artwork for it. So yeah, I still have it up on my official ball. And this is back when it was the American League. Now it's, you know, now it's Major League Baseball balls.
Yeah.
Back then they used to have American League, National League balls still. So yeah. One of the coolest things I have in this whole room.
Yeah, September 12th, 1997, your first hit with the Indians. So, again, success there. But eventually you get traded. 1998, you get traded from Cleveland to Cincinnati. Obviously, it was a great move for you. But was it hard to be traded for the first time?
It was hard, man. It really was. You know, because you think at that time of your life, you're just playing for the Indians. And I remember Mark Shapiro called me in. John Hart was on the phone. He was like, listen, we got good news and bad news. The bad news is you've been traded. The good news is you're going to the Reds, to the big leagues tomorrow. I got traded 14 hours before opening day for the number one starter of the Reds, Dave Burba, the opening day starter. So, you know, part of me was a little nervous, like, man, I hope I, you know, get a warm welcome in Cincinnati. They just traded their opening day starter for a top prospect. You know what I mean? So, but yeah, going to Cincinnati for me, Mike, was the biggest blessing of my life because it gave me a chance to start my career. I mean, coming up behind Jim Thome, you know, that's not a great place to be. So Richie Sexton and I were the two prospects for the Indians. Talk about drafting well. And Richie went on to hit 350 plus home runs in the big leagues too when he got traded. So we both at one point were able to start our careers, but going to Cincinnati was, you know, the biggest move for my career, being there for 8 years and having a chance to make my mark, you know, in the big leagues and be an everyday starter.
1999, kind of your breakout year. Why was that? What came together that year that things clicked for you and you had such a great season?
I just think confidence-wise, I got out the gates. You know, I remember opening day, I think I went 3-for-4 with a home run to tie it late and against the Giants. And then that's the team in the background, that 99 team was one of the most magical teams ever. Mike Cameron, Barry Larkin, Greg Vaughn, Demetri Young, Taubensee, Aaron Boone, Pokey Reese. It was just so, you know, Pete Harnish, Denny Nagel. There were so many good guys in that team. And I think just being a part of that team, like gave me coming out and playing well, making the all-star team in 99 with the all-century team was unbelievable experience. But I just think I got out the gates hard. And I got out fast and was playing really well. I was hitting 371 at the break that summer. I mean, it was incredible when I look back with, like, damn it, we were 17 homers and stuff. So I think that summer of just getting hot really, really gave me a lot of confidence that I could play at an elite, at an all-star level in the league.
Again, as you said, it was your first all-star appearance. What's that like when you make that first appearance and you look around and see all these other big names and stars and probably guys that, you know, you idolized growing up with?
Incredible, man. I almost felt like I won a contest. I was 25 years old. I remember where is at Fenway Park, you know, 1999, you know, last of the before the millennial, you know, last year, and Pedro Martinez starting. I remember walking in the clubhouse in my locker. Vlad Guerrero's next to me. So he was a young kid at the time too. So Vlad was next to me, Mike Piazza to my right, Jeff Bagwell, and then it went down the line like Matt Williams, Randy Johnson, you know, Mark McGwire, Tony Gwynn. I'm like, you got to be kidding me that I'm here. This is amazing. So I was really taking it all in. It was like such an unbelievable experience. And I remember, I think one of the big moments that I had it probably in my whole life was we were on the All Century team had just been introduced too. So because it was 1999, they made this All Century team. So Willie Mays and Hank Aaron and Stan Musial and all these incredible players are on this field with us, right? And we're lining, you know, getting introduced for the game. And Ted Williams comes out of the probably the greatest hitters of all time, comes out in a golf cart. His health wasn't good at the time. And he comes out of the golf cart and comes up. And we're all going to go out to him to throw out the first pitch. And as we're walking up to Ted Williams, there's Tony Gwynn, Mark McGwire at the time. They were bigger than life. Ken Griffey Jr., all these guys. And we're walking up, and I get a pat on my shoulder, and I turn around, and a guy goes, "Hey, man, I just want to introduce myself. My name is George Brett." I'm like, and I was like, the first time I was probably speechless. I didn't know what to say. He's like, "Man, I really like your swing a lot. I like the way you play the game." And I'm like, "Oh, my God." I'm like, "George, it is so nice to meet you. Thanks for coming up and introducing yourself to me. I'm just, like, so honored." And George and I are still very friendly to this day. We still, you know, every once in a while, still see him. We'll text each other and stuff. But that moment for me, and I'll tell you what, one other really quick story about that same moment for me. A few years ago, when we did the red carpet for MLB Network, I was on it with Greg Amsinger and Derek Jeter came up, and we asked Derek Jeter of all the moments of your career, all the championships, all the hits, 3,000 hits, all that stuff. What's the greatest moment of your career? And he said, this is incredible. He said the greatest moment of his career was that same moment. He goes at the all 1999, and he didn't know my story, right? 1999, he said, when Ted Williams came up to throw out the first pitch, he said, "We're walking up to Ted Williams, and I get a pat on my shoulder, and it's Hank Aaron." Oh. And Hank Aaron says to him, "Hey, man, I just want to introduce myself. I'm Hank Aaron. Really love the way you play the game. Love what you're doing for the game. Keep it up." So think about it. Jeter's coming from the American League side. I'm coming from the National League side. We're converging on Ted Williams. I'm having a moment with George Brett. He's having a moment with Hank Aaron at the same exact time as we converge on Ted Williams. I just think that's incredible.
I mean, just, you know, baseball is such a romantic sport from that standpoint, right? Yeah. You know, bringing all these generations together. It must have been hard. I mean, what's going through your mind when a George Brett comes up to you like that? Again, somebody that you idolize, a Hall of Famer, and hey, I like the way you're playing.
That was one of those moments in my life. And I was like, a pinch me moment. Like, is George Brett, like, am I talking to George Brett right now? Did George Brett just seek me out to have a conversation? Like, you got to be kidding me. Like, it was one of those moments. Like, I look back at my career and I got the chills telling that story. Yeah. It's just, you know, like I said, 1992, 7 years earlier, I'm writing 31 letters to any college that'll listen. 7 years later, George Brett knows who I am and is seeking out a conversation with me, walking up at the Major League All-Star game at Fenway Park to go shake Ted Williams' hand before he throws out the first pitch. Like, pinch me now. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It just incredible. You know, again, as you said, 8 years in Cincinnati, great run there. And the mayor, that nickname kind of came around that time because you're at first base, playing first base, and you're just a friendly guy. What are some of the conversations like when a guy gets to first base? You're an outgoing person. What were those conversations like?
Well, you know, it's a small fraternity of guys playing big league baseball, so you do get to know those guys. And, man, I love playing first base because I love talking. I love people. I love having conversations, getting to know guys. And, you know, just I was fortunate to play first base and get to know a lot of different people. I just – some of the conversations, like Lance Berkman was always a great conversation because he wasn't stealing. And you know what I mean? And we could talk for like 5, 6, 7, 8 pitches every at bat. And he was such a great guy. We became good friends over the years. I remember talking to Mark McGwire when he was on that run in 98. And I was a rookie at the time. It was just so cool to like have those conversations. Had some great conversations with Tony Gwynn about hitting at first base, which was really cool. I remember talking to John Olerud about his approach. a couple times. That was really cool. Jeffrey Hammonds, who was one of my favorite teammates with the Reds, he was just such a – I always tell him, but I remember talking to my first base one time. I go, bro, one thing I realized about you, you're the coolest dude I've ever met. Like, I always say, like, you open up the dictionary and you want to look up cool, Jeffrey Hammonds pops up. You know what I mean? So there were so many good conversations, man. I remember at the All-Star game in 99, Carlton Fisk was the first base coach. So I remember having a lot of conversations with him as the game was going on. I think the greatest thing too, Mike, is that, you know, not only the players you get to talk to, you know, the first base umpire, John Hirschbeck's a good friend of mine for all the conversations that we had over there. Dave Collins was one of my favorite coaches with the Reds. When he went to the Rockies after that, I used to love playing the Rockies to have a conversation all game with Dave Collins. So many Dave McKay was with the Cardinals, and so many great first base coaches that I remember having conversations with. So it was just a perfect position for me, brother. That fact that I could, you know, if I was a center fielder, my leash would have been a lot less because it had been so lonely out there, you know?
All right. So you mentioned Lance Berkman. You knew he wasn't going to steal. The guys that you knew were going to steal, did you talk to them to try to distract them?
Oh my God. Well, one of the first conversations I ever had in the big leagues, Ricky Henderson got on first, and I remember holding him on, and I was so excited to talk to him because, dude, I didn't know. I thought my days were numbered. I wasn't hitting well at the time. I was 3 weeks in. I'm like, I got to get as many conversations in as I can. I was also asking guys, like, could you sign a ball and send it over? I'm like, I got to get as many autographs and conversations in as possible before they realize I'm a fraud and they're going to send me out of here, you know? So I remember talking to Ricky Henderson. Hey, man, no way to swing it. You know, really, really big fan of yours. And he kind of looked at me, didn't even respond. And then, bam, he took off running. And I was like, oh, maybe I shouldn't talk to the base stealers. You know what I mean? Like Craig Counsell, I always joke around with Craig Counsell. He was the worst. He would come to first base and never say anything. I'm like, dude, you seem like a good dude. And I asked him afterwards, like a couple of years ago when he was coaching Milwaukee and I was with the MLB Network. And I was like, bro, I was like, what's going on? Like, how come you never said hi to me at first? He's like, bro, he's like, I'm so sorry. He's like, Pat Murphy was my coach at Arizona State. And the guy was, or Notre Dame. He's like, my guy was a stickler for talking to the other team. He's like, I was always scared to say anything to anybody. So that's how I played the game. I was like, oh, that makes sense. So, you know, there was a few guys. One other time, Mike, really quick, my rookie year, I was holding on to Henry Rodriguez. I don't know if you remember him from the Montreal Expos, O. Henry. And back in the day in Montreal, whenever you would homer, they would shower the field with O. Henry bars. And I remember one time we're playing them in Cincinnati and he gets on with a hit, and I remember holding him on. Ron Valone's on the mound, who's a lefty, and I just got called at the big league, so I don't know Ron Valone's move. I don't know really anybody. And Henry gets his lead, and I remember saying to him, hey, man, that's really cool. Excuse me. That's really cool when you hit those home runs in Montreal and everyone showers the field with O. Henry bars. And I remember Henry Rodriguez has his lead, and he turns to me to say, hey, thanks, man. And he's not stealing, right? But right when he turns to me, Ron Valone step off picks with a lefty move. And he throws it to me, man. I catch it. I'm like, oh, my God, do I suck. I'm like, I'm so sorry, dude. Like, I had no idea he was going to pick over. Like, this is such a, you know. So you're out, though. You know, I tagged him out. And I was like, I felt so bad about that. So that's the only time I ever picked a guy off.
With the candy, by accident. The candy bar helped pick him off.
Yeah, the O. Henry candy bar got the Reds an extra out in 1998.
There you go. Well, again, 8 years with the Reds, it eventually comes to an end for you. You get traded, but to your hometown Pirates. Yeah. You know, how did you see that trade? You know, well, obviously you go back closer to home, but again, 8 years were really good in Cincinnati. Yeah,
I was devastated at first. I think because I thought I was going to play my whole career in Cincinnati. It's another one of those things, man. Like we talked about moving from Jersey to Pittsburgh. Is this a good thing? Yes. A lot of times in life, when we think things are the end of the world, they turn out to be the biggest blessings in our life. We just don't see it at that moment. But when you look back, you go, oh, okay, this makes sense. So going to Pittsburgh for me, you know, leaving Cincinnati, I felt devastated, but it turned out it was one of my dreams was to play for the Pirates. I grew up here in Pittsburgh, a big Pirate fan. So I was fulfilling another dream. So played for Pirates. I was so grateful to wear the Pirate jersey. I broke my back like 2 weeks into the season. So the season didn't go exactly as I thought. I came back, ended up hitting pretty well when I came back and got traded to the Tigers. So I almost feel like I was getting to the Tigers via Pittsburgh. And I was with Jim Leland and Andy Van Slyke. All of the coaching staff in Pittsburgh were the guys that I idolized growing up here in Pittsburgh was the coaching staff in Detroit. And I ended up going to the World Series that year, man, in 2006 and having some of the best moments of my whole career. And so I look back about the trade now and I knew it was meant to be. I was meant to go to Pittsburgh, fulfill that dream, get traded, go to Detroit and have a chance to finally play in the World Series. It was my ninth year in the big leagues. I'd never played in the postseason. So it was such a blessing. I'm so grateful for those days.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you learn the business of baseball probably pretty early on. Right. And, you know, it's maybe hard that first time you get traded to not take it personally, but then after that, do you realize, okay, this is a business.
Mm-hmm. Well, no doubt. I was making $8.5 million at the time too. So I knew that Cincinnati was trading my contract. You know, they said they were trading me for pitching, but we traded for a guy named Mike Williams, who was, you know, a decent big leaguer, but you know, I was like, I didn't feel like that was a justification. So, I knew it was a business. And I remember when I got traded my first time, I walked out of the room. It was Mark Shapiro, Buddy Black, and Scott Pioli, who was the GM for the New England Patriots, in those big years. But he was good friends with Mark Shapiro, just happened to be in the room. And I remember Buddy Black saying something to me when I was walking out, you know, who's now the manager of the Rockies. He said, Case, he's like, it won't be your last time, but the first time's always the toughest. First time's always the toughest, but it won't be your last. And he was right. It didn't get easier when you get traded because you're a human being. You feel like, man, why don't they want me? But also on the other end, another team does want you, and you got to kind of look at it that way. You got to spin it in a positive way to say, hey, this team's moving on because of whatever financial reasons they have. The other team's taking it on because they believe that I can help their club. So, you know, I was grateful for Dave Littlefield for trading for me with the Pirates.
Yeah, I mean, nowadays, you know, you don't see that guy playing for that one team his entire career. It just doesn't happen for a lot of different reasons. But again, for you, 9 years it took you to get to the World Series. You finally do get to the World Series with Detroit. What was that like? What was that, you know, that experience? Obviously, you had a good World Series. The Tigers didn't win it, but you personally performed really well.
Yeah. It was an incredible experience. I knew how special it was at that time in my life. I was 9 years in the big leagues. I didn't know if I was going to ever play in the postseason, let alone the World Series. Yeah. You know, we beat the Yankees in the division series. Then we beat Oakland. Then we went to the World Series. So I remember pulling Justin Verlander and Curtis Granderson, aside. And I remember having a conversation with Verlander saying, hey, listen, man, I know you're a rookie and you might think this happens every year, but it doesn't. Like, it's not easy to get to the World Series. This is my ninth year in the big leagues. And I know what a big deal this is. This is a huge deal. So many things have to go right. And so for me, man, I remember getting a hit in game two to put us up, I think 3-0 in the sixth. The roar of the crowd, I'd never heard anything like it. You know, I'd never heard anything like the roar of that crowd and those fans going crazy. And then I hit a home run in game four and game five. And I remember rounding the bases in game four after I homered in St. Louis. And it was almost like the dream within the dream, Mike. It was like, you know, you make the big leagues. I remember that first hit with my dad, looking up at him. And then here we are at the World Series 9 years later, homering in the World Series. And it brings you back to when you're that 12-year-old kid in your backyard playing wiffle ball, saying, and Sean Casey homers in the World Series. And I literally had one of those moments. I remember rounding first base, kind of floating and thinking, oh, my God, I just homered in the World Series. Like, getting to the big leagues is one thing, but getting to the World Series and then homering in the World Series is a totally another thing. So just an incredible experience.
Yeah, you batted .432 in the five games in that postseason in the World Series against the Cardinals. As you said, you came up a little bit short. But, you know, so many great teammates for you through the years, so many names you threw out. Is there a guy that you look to and say, you know, this is kind of the best talent I had a chance to play with during your days?
I mean, Ken Griffey Jr. was the best. I mean, I think he's arguably the greatest player of all time. So to play with him for 6 years in Cincinnati was incredible. You know, he had some unfortunate, you know, injuries when he was there, but I already saw what I needed to see in Seattle. And then when I saw him, when he was healthy in Cincinnati, like, it's just different. The way his swing was the sweetest swing, maybe Major League Baseball has ever seen in the history of the game. And just the way the ball jumped off his bat was different. The way he moved in center field was different. David Ortiz was also another guy in Boston, the way he, you know, was so clutch and the way he could hit. Manny Ramirez, his right-handed swing was probably the best, you know, I'd ever seen. Magley or Adonis that I played with in 06, just the way he I think he had 360 that year, but the way he could hit. Granderson was fun to watch. Justin Verlander, I knew he was going to be I really felt like this a Hall of Fame arm. If he stays healthy, he's got a shot. And just the way he works and the way he goes about his business, you know, that was impressive too. So many great players, man. Yeah. Johnny Lester, Josh Beckett, Euclid was a great player. Mikey Lowell, Dustin Pedroia, man, one of the grittiest dudes I've ever played with. Adam Dunn, some of the greatest power I've ever seen in my whole life. Chris Rizzimo was one of my favorite teammates. Closer, you know, starter, good friend of mine. Just a lot of great players. I'm very Danny Graves. I could go down. There's so many guys, you know, when I think about it. But you know, Austin Kearns, just a lot of great memories, man.
Yeah.
And that lineup. I mean, Mike Cameron. You know, Barry Larkin's one of the greatest ever. Lark was kind of my mentor, and you know, a guy that really showed me how to be a professional. So grateful for him for that. You know, Greg Vaughn was one of the greatest leaders I've ever played with. Dimitri Young, one of the best pure hitters I've ever seen. Eddie Tobinsey, one of my dear friends in the game. Aaron Boone, obviously one of the best managers now, and he could rake too, and was a great teammate for 5 years. And Pokey Reese is probably the best defender I've ever seen in my life. I mean, no one played defense like Pokey Reese. I mean, never seen anything like it. I think a big reason we were so good that year, you had Cameron in center, Larkin at short, and Pokey at second. Like, there wasn't much going up the middle. It was incredible.
Yeah, even without the shift, they were still making the plays, right?
Exactly. Oh, it was unbelievable. Yeah, it didn't matter. That was the shift without the shift. You didn't need it. You know what I mean? These guys covered so much ground.
12 years for you. It eventually ended. You played 69 games for the Red Sox in 2008. When you come to the end, you decide to retire. What goes through that? Again, as a pro athlete, as an athlete, I'm sure you think, hey, you're immortal. You're going to play forever, but it does eventually end.
Yeah. You know what? Being in Boston that last year was incredible. And, you know, I hit 322, so I think I probably had some more in the tank. But I had three kids at the time at home. I was starting, it was my first year off the bench. All those years I'd been a starter. It's a different role off the bench. And listen, it's a tough lifestyle, family lifestyle. And at that point, I just wasn't willing to, wasn't willing to play one or two more years coming off the bench and just keep missing time at home as my kids were starting to start school. That was my thought process at the time. And, you know, I am so thankful and grateful for Major League Baseball, for the game of baseball, for everything that it's meant to me and my family. And it was just time. And I was fortunate enough that Major League Baseball Network was launching that next year. And I was able to kind of fall into that job for the last 15 years. So I'm the luckiest, most blessed human alive, Mike. I there's not a moment in my life that I look back as I'm 48 now. And I just say, you know, thank you, God, for everything that's happened.
Yes. And you know, as such an outgoing personality, I would think it was a no doubter that you were going to go into, you know, broadcasting. Yeah. MLB Network. You've got, you know, the Mayor podcast as well. Right. Was that in your mind as you were coming toward the close of your career?
Yeah, a little bit. I didn't know what I was going to do, but yeah, I thought about it. I didn't know how it was going to happen though. And I met Harold Reynolds at game 5. It's just another divine intervention. You know, I met Harold Reynolds at game 5. He was doing TBS work. I mean, MLB Network didn't even exist yet. And, he came up to me, you know, to talk around the cages. And I'm like, hey, Harold, how do you like being a studio analyst? He's like, I love it. He's like, why are you asking that? I was like, well, I'm done after this. I'm going to retire after this year. He's like, dude, you're hitting 322. I was like, yeah, I know. I was like, but I'm ready. And he was the guy to put me in touch with Tony Petitti, who was starting MLB Network. And he's like, you got to talk to Tony Petitti. So sure enough, he reached out to Tony. Tony reached out to me, and they launched January 1st, 2009. That was October 2008. And, you know, here I am 15 years later working at the network. It's been one of the greatest jobs I've ever had in my life. And not a second goes by that I don't appreciate that job and just still being a part of Major League Baseball and being in the game.
Yeah, is that kind of – does it give you the feeling of being part of a team still?
It does. Yeah, it really does. You know, there's so many guys, you know, Greg Amsinger's, Matt Bascursian's, you know, Robert Flores, you know, Adnan Virk, the host, and then, you know, Millar and Plesac and D. Rowe and Cliff Floyd and Carlos Pena and Yonder Alonso and Chris Young and – just some really, really good dudes. CC Sabathia, a lot of good dudes that are a part of that network. It makes you feel like you're part of the team. Al Leiter, yeah. So many great guys. Jimmy Tomey. I was flipping to Jim Tomey a couple months ago. We were doing a demo and never heard a wiffle ball whistle like that in my life. I'm like, geez, that wiffle ball is literally screaming. And I remember thinking, like, this is incredible. Like, I'm getting paid right now to do a hitting demo with Jim Tomey, and I'm flipping him wiffle balls. You got to be kidding me, you know?
Incredible. Yeah, is that part of the best part of it when you get to do those demos? You get to kind of break down somebody and do a little coaching there, and sometimes in the studio.
Yeah, I love it, man. The coaching part of it's great. Being able to get out there and maybe if kids are watching, you know, show the kids, some of the things that you learned about your process, about your, you know, about hitting it in general and the techniques and all that stuff. I love the demo part of the job. It's great.
Tell us a little bit about the Mayor podcast and how that got started. And it looks like you're doing a lot of those these days.
Yeah. We're doing it every day. We do it every day. At the Mayor's, the Mayor's Office podcast. We do it every day. I do it with my buddy, Rich Cinciamino, who's just one, I feel like one of the best producers in the world. He was at MLB Network with me for 14 years. And we do it every day. You can find us on Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. And also on YouTube, you know, we take pride in that. We do it like you do. We do a video. We just hit our 230th episode the other day with Bronson Arroyo playing some tunes on the air, which was cool. I just love doing it, man. I love doing it like you probably love doing it. I love getting guys on. I love picking their brains. We try to have a guest once a week. And the other days, Chinch and I are just talking baseball, talking life, talking mental performance, you know, which is great. And I just started a mental performance coaching program too called Breakthrough Pro that I'm about to launch, Breakthrough Pro 2, the second session. And I think the mental part of baseball was such a big part of my life and the mental part of life really too. And so I love taking some of the skills that I've learned over the years. And I put together a really cool program, you know, for kids 14 and older, but it's really for adults and kids, you know, just like we say, breakthrough to a pro mindset in life. So I got a lot of cool things happening, man. I'm very, very grateful for a lot of passion projects and things that are going on. And it's just been a lot of fun, Mike.
Have you done some coaching with your kids? I know you've got a son at Dayton, a son at Kent State as well. Were you their coach growing up?
Yeah, I was their coach growing up. You know, not the head coach. I was always the assistant coach, so I didn't have to send out the emails. You know what I mean? I did the fun stuff. Excuse me. I did the fun stuff with, just being able to do the hitting, fielding, pitching and stuff like that. And it's fun now, you know, my son's a sophomore at Kent State playing baseball. So still get a chance to work with him when he comes home and hit in the cages and talk baseball. So it kind of gives me my fix.
Almost out of time, but I want to ask you a couple of things about the current game, obviously with some of the changes, the pitch clock and doing away with the shifts as well. What's been your take on what they're trying to do and try to speed up the game, which, you know, again, you're kind of an older school guy that came up in the 90s and earlier than that in college. But, you know, what do you think about some of the changes they've made?
I love it. I love it. You know, it's like you think about the NBA without the 24-second shot clock, without the three-point line. Think about football without the play clock. You think about, you know, all that stuff. I mean, the games, people would say, no, that would be a terrible product because it's better with the clock. The game, listen, at the end of the day, the attention spans of all of us now are a lot less. And, you know, we want to see action. So the 15 second pitch clock, 20 second clock when guys are on base, I think it's a great thing. They did 8,000 innings in the minor leagues, and they proved, the proof was in the pudding that the games were, you know, right around 238, 240, taking off 20 some minutes. That's a big deal. The games are, the balls put in play more. Strikeouts were less. More, with the bigger bases, more guys are stealing. It'll be interesting to see with the shift. You know, I think it's better with, you know, that they're taking it, that they're making it make it like an illegal defense. But we'll be interesting to see how that rule goes, because that's more of a player adjustment rule. And I don't know how many rules you can keep digging in on as far as that goes. But it'll be interesting to see. I'd like to see it that it's back straight up again, and we'll see where it goes.
And you think ERAs for pitchers are going to go up and people have to look at that when they're looking at, you know, contracts, contract renewals, when you see some of these big pitchers?
Well, I think that, you know, it definitely helps the hitters a little bit. But the pitching has been so dominant these last few years, and the strikeouts are, you know, yeah, at an epic epidemic. You know, if there's an epidemic of baseball, it's guys are striking out 200 times a year and no one's even blinking an eye now. So I think it's a better product when the ball is put in play more.
How much are you on social media? How can people follow you?
Yeah, man, I'm on Instagram at the mayor's office, MLB. And I'm also on Twitter at the mayor's office. And if you want to find us on, for the new coaching program, you can go to breakthrough-pro.com. And that's where you can find it. Yeah. And then that is my SeanCasey.live, website too. So, yeah. So I'm doing keynote speeches, all that stuff, but I'm all over the place, Mike, doing a lot of stuff that I really enjoy though. And I'm very grateful for it. So yeah. You can find us there, and also find our podcast at the mayor's office, with Sean Casey. It's on Spotify, Apple, and you can find it on YouTube too.
As you said, your dad was such a great influence on you. Did you take after him? Are you outgoing? Was he an outgoing guy?
He's an outgoing guy. Big time outgoing guy. My mom, I'm a mix of both of them. My dad's a very outgoing guy, and my mom has the gift of gab. My mom could talk to you, Mike. She doesn't know you. My mom could talk to you for the next 4 hours, and you would walk away and go, what an incredible conversation that was. I don't even know her. So my mom is just the best. And, you know, but my dad is great too. They're, you know, just a very outgoing personality. And so I'm grateful that they're my parents.
Well, this has been an outstanding conversation. And again, your dad was right. Write those letters. And that 31st led to what has become an outstanding career for you. And can't thank you enough for sharing that journey with us here today.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Mike. Really, really appreciate having me on. And good luck down there at UNCW too, brother. And that's a beautiful area.
Yeah, you know this. What, do you remember what your record was against the Seahawks during your
days? I think we did pretty well against them. Do you know? Okay. I know we did well against them. I remember my freshman year, I believe the CAA tournament was there. I remember facing Wayne Gomes there, and he was throwing like 100. I'm like, whoa, that's different. You know what I mean? So we loved coming down to UNCW.
Yeah, CAA, a lot of talent. You mentioned Verlander, who played Old Dominion in the CAA at that time as well, or after you, I guess, as well. But Sean, again, can't thank you enough for joining us. Best of luck this year in the MLB Network and certainly with a podcast. Had a chance to watch a couple earlier today and very entertaining podcast as well.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Mike. And good luck to you, brother, and I'll see you down the road.
Wow, another great guest there. Sean Casey joining us. Great personality, big personality as well. Appreciate his time. Also, a special thanks to Randy Slack for helping connect us with Sean for today's episode. As always, thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. And we remind you again to subscribe to our channel. You don't want to miss such great guests we have lined up coming up here very shortly. Until then, Mike DeCaro here, JR Equipment behind the scenes. We thank you for watching or listening. We'll see you next time for another edition of In the Front Row with Mike DeCaro. Have a great day, everybody.